As the midterm elections get closer, the political rhetoric about nearly everything from taxes to health care to defense spending is heating up. But one area of public policy has remained remarkably cool this election season: global warming. Our series, The Big Picture, continues today with a look at why hardly anyone on the campaign trail is talking about climate change and the environment. And we're joined now by New York Times science reporter Andrew Revkin, whose blog is called Dot Earth, and by Ryan Litza, The New Yorker's Washington correspondent. His article, As the World Burns, appears in the current issue of the magazine. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
Andrew, this year we had the worst oil spill in U.S. history in the Gulf of Mexico, record-breaking temperatures on both coasts, glaciers are still melting, and Barack Obama said that the environment would be his number one priority during his presidential campaign. So why is no one talking about climate change and the environment in this election?
The economy. I don't want to say the line from the Clinton era, but among other things, oil prices are still are low. Gasoline prices are as low as they've been for a while. So even with the Gulf staying, which, of course, you know, is over, I think there were people, even in the administration early on, who saw that as kind of fading by the fall. And in the meantime, climate, among some very partisan parts of the electorate, the most motivated voters, has become a third rail in a number of elections, especially where there's, you get 20% or so of hardcore Republicans who just absolutely reject this, and so it's become dangerous to some folks who are up for re-election.
In energy-producing states, hasn't it become one of the anti-Obama issues?
Yeah, for sure, and you've seen that already, even in some of the primary races. This was deployed, and so on a political level, climate, you know, again, in the polling, the surveying, while it's shown kind of public attitudes, if you ask them what worries, if you ask the average person, does global warming worry you, then many say, most say yes. But if you ask the average person, what worries you these days, and don't specify something, it never is on the list. So it's not a salient issue. And political strategists, all the political strategists and social scientists I talk to say, salience is the thing that makes politicians and their teams pay attention, not sort of some vague sense that something is of concern when you ask about it.
Ryan, your article in The New Yorker lays out the failed efforts of Senators John Kerry, Joe Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham to get a cap-and-trade bill through Congress this term, an attempt that you write was, quote, the last best chance to deal with global warming in the Obama era. How close did they get?
Well, you know, that is a very tough thing to answer. I don't think we'll ever really know, because you don't really know if you're going to get to the magical number of 60 votes until you call the question. You know, senators don't, on a controversial piece of legislation like that, don't commit until they absolutely have to. So Obama's been pretty successful about forcing a very dysfunctional institution to produce pretty important legislation. You know, you look at the stimulus, you look at health care, you look at the bank reform bill. Those are major pieces of legislation, all done in a relatively short period of time. All of them, when they started, there were people that would say, oh, he will never get 60 votes for that. Everyone said that about climate change, and we'll never know because, frankly, the administration made some strategic errors, and at a certain point in 2010, they really did just give up trying to pass it.
There was a lot of talk about a grand bargain on climate change. What was that?
Yeah, I was in the White House doing interviews in March of 2009, and talking about climate change with a very senior official there, and he said, "Look, this is it's obvious what the quote-unquote grand bargain is. Democrats get their cap on carbon, and in exchange, we expand oil drilling, and we re-energize the nuclear power industry in this country, which are the two big things that Republicans care about." And That's not a huge secret. Democrats in Congress knew that was that was the nature of the deal that had to be struck on this issue. And frankly, if you go back to early 2009, you can find plenty of quotes from Republicans who were flirting with the idea of passing this. Remember, in 2008, the Lieberman-Warner cap and trade bill got Andrew, you may have to help me here. I forget, but 7 or 8 Republicans supported it. Now it failed, yeah. But 7 or 8 Republicans supported it. Just a year later, the politics of the issue, mostly among Republicans, completely changed. I mean, the big polling change, if you look, there are two big polling things. One is the salience issue that Andrew mentioned. In January of this year, I think Pew did a poll where they asked voters to rank 21 different issues. Climate change was dead last, number 21. So there's the salience issue. But the second issue is among Republicans, global warming skepticism has become much, much more powerful. And if you look at the polls about what Americans believe the effects of global warming are occurring, all the shift is among Republicans. Republicans going from 2 years ago saying, yeah, it's happening, to a majority saying they're not quite sure anymore. And that put enormous pressure on the Republican Party in 2009 and 2010 to abandon any of the negotiations with Democrats.
President Obama announced before the BP oil spill that he was supporting increased offshore oil drilling and that he was in favor of more loan guarantees for nuclear power. So did the BP oil spill also effectively mess up any opportunity for some legislation to be passed?
Yeah, I'll tell you, writing this piece really taught me something about how legislation is made in Washington right now. And from the outside, you might have looked and said, wow, okay, Obama's aides said they were going to do this grand bargain. Oh, and then there they go. They put these nuclear loan guarantees in their budget. Okay, so they're following through on that part of the deal. And then they announced the expanded offshore drilling. So it looks like they're following through on that part of the deal. But then when I started interviewing the senators who are actually trying to build the coalition to put this together, I learned that they were infuriated that the White House made these decisions without consulting them or without making them part of a Senate deal.
The same sort of thing that happened during the health care debate.
Yes. Well,
the president was accused of being willing to sacrifice the public option too early in the negotiations and left the Congress out of the whole thing.
Yes, in other words, exactly, giving away things prematurely. But I will say there was a difference in the healthcare debate and the climate change debate. The White House was engaged at a much more granular level in some of the deals that needed to be made to make healthcare pass. On climate change, because some of those deals had become so toxic, because some of the healthcare deals, they decided that they were not going to engage in them, and that they treated the process they were at arm's length from the process. And this, from the senator's perspective, was a big mistake, and it took away what in the Senate they called their deliverables. In other words, Lindsey Graham didn't have deliverables that he could take to his conservative colleagues and say, hey, you support this cap, and I'll get you that oil drilling. You support this cap, and we'll restart the nuclear industry. Because Obama, in their view, had already given those things away.
He hasn't figured out the whole business of horse trading that other president, like Lyndon Johnson, understood so well. Andrew, many critics argued that the president should have used the BP oil spill as a reason to rally public support around environmental legislation. If you remember, an oil spill off the coast of California in the 60s gave us the EPA. Do you think that the administration missed an opportunity? Are you there, Andrew?
They've lost him. But
okay, Ryan?
Well, yeah. See, I think the BP oil spill, I mean, can't overuse this phrase, I mean, the tragic irony of that oil spill when you think about its relationship to the climate change debate, I mean, it actually had the opposite effect in the Senate. I know a lot of environmentalists believe that it could rally the country behind this change, but that spill occurred at the same time that Kerry and Lieberman were finishing their bill. Now, their bill included a dramatic expansion of offshore oil drilling. It went further than the Obama announcement. And so when the oil drilling, when the BP disaster happened, they were kind of left with this piece of legislation that was now politically toxic. So the whole nature of the grand bargain was dead once the spill happened, and it made the politics even more difficult. And there was no way that the Republicans still wanted the expansion of drilling, but you were not going to get any Democrats to sign off on that. So it really once that spill happened, the grand bargain strategy. Obviously backfired.
My guests are Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker and Andrew Revkin of The New York Times. We're talking about climate change on as part of our Big Picture series. Pretty much every president since Richard Nixon has made the point that we need to get away from our dependence on fossil fuels. George W. Bush went so far as to call oil an addiction. So, Andrew, has the Obama administration been much different than any of its predecessors? In this
area?
Well,
no. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, the big one thing to keep in mind is speaking about oil is just one small component of the climate challenge. If you have an energy bill that doesn't deal with coal, is not a climate bill. And so there was always realization, and there's always been this fundamental dynamic, even within the lobbying that goes on and within which states are for or against, which senators or congressmen are for or against, not so much based on oil as on coal. We know we need, in fact, on .earth, I wrote this piece early on, that the reality is we kind of need more oil before we use less, and Obama had said that pretty straightforwardly, but the coal issue is what dominates the climate question. In fact, most of the scientists doing emissions trajectories essentially assume that oil, because it is so valuable and for the moment not replaceable with other options, will be burned. It's coal that is key. And that's what has led to the much more difficult politics on a climate bill than on a quote-unquote energy bill.
Because so many of the Midwestern states depend on coal for energy?
Oh, yeah. Those states are also very used to very cheap electricity. It's a fraction of what we pay in the New York area. And their economies are still driven. Half of the country's electricity still comes from coal. So it's that dynamic. This plays all the way back to the Clinton-Gore effort to have a BTU tax. That was, in the end, defeated by this little fight over how much of the sort of costs of doing that would go to the coal industry versus the oil industry. And it was Democrats, including Robert Byrd, the departed Robert Byrd, who essentially pulled the plug on that energy tax at that time. And
he's from West Virginia, and if you're a Democrat from West Virginia, you are opposed climate change legislation.
Pretty much.
Although, this is lots of tragic irony in this debate. At the end of his life, Robert Byrd wrote an op-ed in a newspaper in West Virginia where, he didn't exactly sound like Al Gore, but he did try and tell his constituents and tell his fellow West Virginians that, change is coming and we've got to figure out a way to transition to that change and get in front of this thing. Now, there's a lot of debate about some people called this a deathbed conversion on the issue and said that he'd really had what environmentalists sometimes call his polar bear moment. Other people say, well, despite that op-ed, he probably wouldn't have supported cap and change. But he certainly signaled a pretty big shift to the point where his aides actually recorded Robert Byrd reading the op-ed because they thought that a lot of people wouldn't believe that he had written it. Now, Robert Byrd died as this debate was sort of nearing its end, and the person who's running to replace him has been running as far away as he possibly can from any support of climate change legislation.
Last month, the president gave an interview in Rolling Stone in which he said, one of my top priorities next year is to have an energy policy that begins to address all facets of our over-reliance on fossil fuels. And they've just put some solar panels on the White House. I wonder if that's what he's talking about. He also said that he wanted to roll out his policy in chunks. Andrew, do we know what that means?
Well, I blogged on the chunky climate policy the other day, and no, we don't yet know what it means. But what it does mean is, I think, you know, I think campaigners and those in the political sphere who got so tied into the cap and trade idea and the idea that we need a quote-unquote comprehensive climate and energy bill, you know, this all grew out of the 2007 climate panel report and Al Gore's momentum and all that. And then I think reality has sort of settled in that this is a longer-term process. It's not even a one-presidency process. Decarbonizing a global, a growing global energy system is an epic challenge. And so the idea of sequencing, starting with modest steps, even though there is a sense of urgency, and looking at the realities of the polarized capital, I think is the right way to go. And that means Stephen Schneider, one of the foremost climate scientists of our time, who just passed away a month or two ago, I quoted him from a 2006 speech he gave in Australia, which has similar political issues with climate, where he said sequencing is vital, starting with demonstrable steps on things like a clean power plant or whatever. Do that first and then build the support for the broader, grander, and tougher issues like adding a price to carbon is the only way to go. And I think that's kind of what you're seeing.
Ryan, you interviewed Al Gore for your article in the current issue of The New Yorker, and he said of the dead cap and trade bill that it's virtually impossible for participants in the current political system to enact any significant change without first seeking and gaining permission from the largest commercial interests who are most affected by the proposed change. Did many of the other people you spoke to in Washington feel that way? And I want to have a follow-up question, which is, where is Al Gore right now?
Not only did they agree with that, but that was literally the operating premise of how you pass this legislation. You go and you sit down with the coal industry, or more specifically, the utility industry, and the oil companies. And right there, those are the two most important interest groups, right? The two major sources of carbon emissions in the U.S. are from the cars we drive, or, you know, our transportation sector, and from the coal we burn to get electricity. Then you sit down with the manufacturers, and you sit down with the Chamber of Commerce, and all these groups. And, you know, in some parts of the Senate bill, you literally let them write language that is acceptable to them, and not just so to please them, but because if you don't do that, they will run millions of dollars in ads savaging your bill. So Cary Graham and Lieberman literally sat down with the Chamber of Commerce and got an agreement that, no, they won't support the bill, but they're not going to go to war against it. They sat down with the Edison Electric Institute, which represents most of the utilities in this country, and got their acquiescence to essentially support the bill. They made a very explicit agreement with three major oil companies, BP, ConocoPhillips, and Shell, that those oil companies would work to silence the American Petroleum Institute, which was then running millions and millions of dollars in ads savaging the House bill. And they cut that deal so that they wouldn't come out and hammer the legislation. That is, Gore was exactly right. That's how it works. Now, I wouldn't necessarily blame Cary Graham and Lieberman. They are senators operating in the system that we have, and that was the only way to do this.
Well, has the Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court, which has opened the door to unlimited corporate donations and elections, shaped how we even talk about the environment? I'm thinking about business interests like the Koch brothers backing a number of global warming deniers.
You know, I'm not an expert on that, but I don't think the evidence shows yet that decision has – there are ways for corporations prior to that decision to have a pretty big impact with advertising and lobbying. That is a new – that makes it a lot easier, and they can do it more directly. So I don't know if their spending flows directly from that decision, but that one will certainly make it easier in the future.
Andy?
Well, the reality still, even with the pushing and pulling on legislation, is that in an underlying way, we remain very in a comfort zone with energy, and the climate challenge the world faces is still long-term. So In fact, I did a piece a couple of years ago. Remember when Al Gore did his own $300 million ad campaign, or tried to initiate that on climate? I interviewed some people in marketing, like professors of marketing, and they were saying that Coke and Pepsi spend billions of dollars each year to tweak the needle, like 2 or 3% in terms of who buys which soda. So my guess is that even in that sense, I know that advertising is all targeted at Beltway, specifically at the Beltway. It might make a difference, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that in the grand scheme of things, moving meaningfully on climate, which is a separate question from having a climate bill, is a big deal. It's going to take a long time.
What are your thoughts about California's Prop 23, which is on the ballot for this election, a measure that would undercut the state's landmark law, which regulates greenhouse gas emissions? Do we know where that measure is polling?
It's very tight. I don't know what the New Yorker has heard lately, but it's apparently it's very tight. There's a lot of oil money flowing there, a lot of Coke money, and
that's KOCH Coke.
Yeah, right. As opposed to Pepsi and Coke.
And I think this is sort of the near term future is lots of action at the state level, lots of lawsuits both on the environmental side and the utility and oil industry side, and piecemeal regulation trying to get at this issue. And that's why I think what Carrie Graham and Lieberman and the White House were trying to do for one brief moment there is get a bipartisan agreement that had environmental and corporate buy-in. That's a whole lot better than what we're going to see in the next few years, which, you know, Eric Pooley, who's written a book about this subject, calls, you know, the glorious mess. We're going to have a glorious mess of regulation, legislation, and regional combat on this issue in the near term.
There was an article on the front page of today's New York Times about how the U.S. military has ordered less dependence on fossil fuels, and the Environmental Protection Agency plans to start regulating the carbon emissions of power plants, cement kilns, and other stationary sources early next year. So is that the way we're going to approach this problem rather than hoping for legislation?
So that's where we're going next is EP regulation. And during the debate in the House and Senate, the White House and senators held that over the head of the utilities and the oil industry. They said, look, if you don't sign on to a cap and trade bill, what's coming is going to be so much worse for you, and that is command and control EP regulation. I can't find anyone that thinks EP regulation is a better way to go than the cap and trade legislation.
On the other hand, some Senate opponents have tried all year to strip the EPA of its authority to regulate carbon because they knew this was coming.
Yeah, so now it's so the worst of all worlds from the perspective of someone who thinks you really need to deal with this problem is that the EPA moves forward with their regulation, and that provokes a backlash from conservatives, from interest groups who really sort of rise up and demand that Congress takes another shot at stripping that regulation away from the EPA. Now, Obama, you know, my understanding is, you know, Obama would successfully veto that legislation, but that's for your listeners, the next debate to really pay attention to is the EPA regulation debate and what backlash it provokes in Congress. And that's the most important fight for the administration going forward, is defending the EPA's right to regulate carbon as a pollutant.
Well, right now, the big debate is over cap and trade, which most experts say is the best way to deal with climate change causing pollution. But opponents call it cap and tax. There are going to be more Republicans in Congress, even if they don't wind up taking over the majority in this next Congress. So do you see that this whole issue is going to be pretty dead in the near future?
Well, it doesn't have to be at all. If Obama can shift the rhetoric away from one thing, that there's a whole quieter chorus out there who've been calling for a long time for an energy revolution that can be cast in a fundamentally new way than the way that the climate issue has been portrayed has been as a climate crisis, a pollution problem, when in fact the root of it is we don't have the energy technologies that are cheap enough to give us clean sources of electricity and mobility on a large scale. And that, and what's really disturbing about the current fight, the damage from what happened, is that even getting a modest revenue flow for innovation, for this deployment of solar stuff and for R&D, the basic kind of inquiry. I was at two meetings in the last 2 weeks in Stanford and at MIT of young innovators who are just so eager to push forward with stuff, and they see the stimulus money that was targeted at R&D and that kind of thing going away momentarily, and Congress has no interest in that. If a president stood up and said, there's a way forward, we're going to become the energy innovator of the world and the century, and we're going to reduce the risk facing the Pentagon, and we're going to reduce the risk facing climate by advancing energy technologies that can work here and overseas, there's a way, I think, to build support. On the other
side, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. New York Times science reporter Andrew Rivkin, Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker. We have links to Andrew's blog and to Ryan's article in The Current New Yorker on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.